The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Scott Weinberg is a veteran film critic. Steven DeGennaro is a doctor of astrophysics. Listen in as these two nerds compare and contrast two noteworthy sci-fi films every week. They'll discuss the artistic quality of the films, whether they get the science right, and whether or not that even matters. Welcome to Science vs. Fiction.
Hey, welcome back to another episode of Science vs. Fiction. It is a podcast in which a film critic and an astrophysicist discuss motion pictures, two of them, of the scientific persuasion, and then we discuss their quality and their scientific intelligence. My name is not Steven DeGennaro, and I am not joined by Scott Weinberg. Hi, Steven.
Hi, I am not Weinberg.
He is not, and I am not DeGennaro. So, Steven, tell our listeners, our loyal, wonderful listeners who are now listening to us on the Audio Boom Network, thank you, tell us what we're going to be matching up this week.
Today, we are going to be talking about two different movies about aliens that both star Henry Thomas. And those movies are E.T., The Extraterrestrial, and Fire in the Sky.
Well, now, both of these films are about aliens visiting Earth, Steven. How different could they be?
They are as different as two movies about aliens visiting Earth could possibly be.
Fair enough. Let us start off with Steven Spielberg's 1982 beloved sci-fi family adventure classic. I would also call it a comedy in a way. E.T. the Extraterrestrial, one of the biggest box office hits of all time. And I love to tell this anecdote, Steven. When I was growing up, I lived near a two-house theater.
Right.
And there was a 10, and I'm not exaggerating, 10-month period where E.T. played in one of these theaters and the other was just constantly changing. And every time my sister and I would be in the back of the car driving past, she'd say, did they get anything else yet? And E.T. I mean, 10 months. Yeah. Can you imagine something playing at your theater for 10 months?
I can't imagine something playing at my theater for 10 weeks.
Right, exactly. E.T. was epically, massively, gigantically huge. I think my sister liked it even more than I did. I know I saw E.T. over that 10-month period at least 3 or 4 times. At least.
Yeah.
And it is a magical, beautiful movie. I, in my opinion, easily one of Steven Spielberg's best. Definitely one of his most personal, one of his most heartfelt and sweetest. And I think that what is so wonderful about this movie is that it is just a really interesting slice of life about a family that has gone through a tragedy and is now getting back together. And they just happen to be visited by an alien at the time. And that kind of crystallizes the conflicts that they're going through.
Yeah.
And so it is this wonderful juxtaposition of, yeah, an alien visits a kid and they hide him in his closet. Yeah, that's a pretty outlandish. But everything else in E.T. rings true. The suburbia, the friends, the loyalty between your big brother and your little sister, your mother who is a wonderful person, but, you know, if you push her too far, she's human too, and she might break. You know, it's right. Just a beautiful movie about moms and kids and relationships, and it's all filtered through this crazy story of this adorably ugly little alien that befriends Elliot. And I was half expecting to revisit the film and be like, yeah, it's a cute kids movie. And you know, obviously I like it, but it's a kids movie. No, this is a beautiful film. It is a beautiful movie. And, you know, anybody who's listened to our last few episodes will know that I'm crossing my fingers right now, praying that Steven's not going to be like, dude, are you crazy? It's not that good. So over to you, Steven.
I mean, I was a little younger than you when this came out. I was 5 in the summer of 82. So the first time I saw this was in the drive-in at, I said drive-thru. It's drive-thru theater. You catch like a minute and a half of it and then you're...
Yo, can I get 3 burgers or fries and E.T.? For 2 hours, I'll sit here and watch it.
So I saw this at the drive-in. I have, only impressionistic recollections of that screening. Obviously, I remember that summer, it being the summer of E.T., in a lot of ways, at least for kids my age and my older brother's age. But then, I probably saw it a handful of times elsewise growing up, probably on VHS or whatever. It's not a movie we owned. It's not a movie that, like, we as kids, like, return to over and over again for whatever reason. Like, there's
right. Let me ask you this, though. When it was brought up, when, like, you know, certain movies, when people bring up, like, Babe, and even if you don't love it, you know, oh, that's a critically, like, people love that family movie.
Yeah.
They love Babe.
Oh, I love Babe.
So, like,
how could you not love Babe?
Yeah. Oh, so do I. I like the second one even better. But like, is it like that where when you were growing up, did you know that E.T. was almost like movie royalty?
Yeah. I mean, I think everybody knew it immediately. Like, okay, E.T. is one of the greatest movies of all time. It was one of the biggest, it was probably in some ways outside of Star Wars, the first hit movie that I can sort of remember experiencing or seeing, you know, the way that it exploded in pop culture at a time when I could finally, like, form memories.
It's fascinating to me how big of a hit it was. You know, I it's not just that it's a good movie, because lots of really good movies don't make that kind of money. But I think that the world was just really hungry for this kind of story. You know, the idea that an alien would land and be completely, a little bit scary, but completely friendly and benign, that concept was not very prevalent. That was just, you know, it was, we visit aliens and they're either a threat or a mystery. That's it.
Right.
They're never a friend.
Right.
And this movie, you know, like setting it up so that he's friends with a young boy who's just old enough to know it's scary, but just young enough to accept it.
Yeah.
You know, that's the key. If the kid is too old, you're like, what? If the kid is too young, it's kind of scary. Yeah.
Well, and he's got the range of ages. Obviously, the movie is about Elliot, but he's got the younger sister and he's got the older brother. And one of the things that rings most true to me about this movie, even just watching it this week, was the relationships among them and the ways that they talk to one another, the way that there's sort of subtle rivalries, but also solidarity. And that, you know, totally rings true to me. I had three siblings, an older brother, a younger brother, a younger sister. And so very much in a lot of ways similar to this family. And, you know, like I said, I was a couple years younger than Elliot was when this movie came out, but obviously I passed through that age at some point. And, just that feeling of, like, your siblings can be colossal dicks, but they can also have your back.
Yeah. There is this unspoken connection between the three siblings that even if they're, you know, they'll be sniping at each other, and then 5 seconds later they have each other's back. And it, like you said, it really does ring true to that sibling thing where your brother or your sister could quote unquote hate you, but if somebody else messes with you, then they're immediately in your corner.
Right. So, I will say that my job in this podcast is to think about things critically and to think about things from a scientific point of view and from a logic point of view. And so I'm going to warn you and warn everybody else that, like, I'm going to bring up some stuff that's probably going to make some people a little mad. And it will, some of it, I don't know. I'm going to try to make sure that it's not nitpicky, because it's not meant to be nitpicky. I think one of the things that makes this movie resonate with people so much is that so much of it is sort of seen through the eyes of this 8-year-old child. And the things that he will believe about things are radically different than what an adult might believe or find plausible. And I think that that is part of the charm of it. I think it's absolutely part of the intent of it on Spielberg's part as well. But I'm obviously approaching it from the point of view of a 43-year-old astrophysicist whose job is to, not to pick it apart necessarily, but to sort of think about these things and to wonder, okay, well, what are the scientific implications of various different creative choices that got made in the movie? And so I have a lot of questions.
So what you're saying is, I get it. Bicycles can't fly. I get it. God.
No, Steven. That's one of the least, I mean, that's one of the most plausible parts of the movie as far as that stuff goes. All right, so let's talk about some scientific stuff. And I'm going to go from the beginning and we'll just kind of work our way through.
Okay, are flowers telepathically connected to an alien's life cycle? Yes or no?
Yes.
Okay, good to know.
Scientifically true.
Go ahead.
No, well, so that's one of my first questions. Is E.T., are they botanists? Are they scientists here on a mission to sort of collect samples on Earth? Are they explorers? Are they florists, you know, interstellar florists who, you know, only find the best flowers from various different places in the universe? Like, again, I'm not necessarily saying I need an answer to that question.
No, but you wouldn't send a florist to a foreign planet. You would send a botanist. Come on. But, you know, I love that. I love that, you know, and I know you know that there's no answer.
Right.
But I love the idea that all we know is that they were in an isolated part of the country in the forest collecting samples. That's what the film tells us. They're not looking for humans. They're not looking
right
for a civilization.
Right.
They are clearly just looking for, like, flora and fauna. It's fascinating.
Let's talk about that first assertion. You said an isolated part of the country. So one of my biggest issues with this opening sequence is how not isolated it is.
Well, I mean, they landed in the forest is what I mean by that.
Right. But they landed in the forest on top of a mountain that overlooks what I presume is Los Angeles, or it's a suburb of Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Wherever it is, the point is it's a city. You can see streets, there's roads, whatever, and they are flying this giant ship that is not in stealth mode, by the way. It has like these massive floodlights on it, and it launches up into the sky. Like a million people would see that thing taking off and landing.
Yeah. Yeah.
It is not remotely, in any way, does not look hidden or isolated to me.
Let's be fair. You could say that about any alien movie. Any, you know.
Yeah, but, you know, in contrast to, like, the one that we're going to cover next, where they were in a much more isolated part of the country, in a much more isolated part of the woods.
What about the physical makeup of E.T.? Does that strike you in any way interesting?
I mean, he kind of looks like a scrotum, to be completely frank.
Whoa.
He's a scrotum with eyes.
I mean, God, it must be so difficult. Carlo Rambaldi, the genius who sculpted and created the character, it must be so difficult if your marching orders are, we want it to be as alien as possible without it being disturbing or like, and it is a little creepy in moments, but it is also kind of sweet.
And we don't want it to look like anything else that people have done before either.
Exactly. But yeah, it does. And I think that your scrotum comment is kind of a compliment to the biological nature of the creature.
It's pretty ugly, to be completely honest. And
it
isn't, you know,
but it's ugly in the way that an ugly dog is ugly.
I will say this about I'm going to get pilloried for this, but like, I think you have to be fully invested in the magic of this movie for that effect to work in 2020, at least. Obviously, 1982 would be a very different story. But, there's a moment later on in the movie where Dee Wallace comes across, where she finally sees it for the first time. Actually, there was a scene a little bit earlier where she almost sees it and Drew Barrymore keeps trying to point it out to her and she keeps, you know, strategically turning and looking in the fridge at exactly the wrong moment or whatever.
Yeah, I love that.
I'm thinking as this scene is going on, I'm like, if she turns around and sees this, my first thought on seeing that would not be, oh, there's an alien in the house. It would be, why is there a guy wearing a rubber suit in my kitchen?
Oh, God, no.
So, and you know, that's partly because of the limitations of the technology of 1982, but it doesn't fully hold up for me in that regard.
To me, I think the E.T. effect is like watching a Ray Harryhausen film, which is that what you're watching is 80% perfect, and when it's not perfect and you see the stick underneath the foot or a thumbprint, I don't care.
Right.
That's just part of the beauty of filmmaking. I just don't care. So I think I think E.T. is, like, if you don't like the design of the creature, I don't mean you, but if in general you don't enjoy the design of the creature, then that's one thing. But I think it's unique and interesting. I do. And a little bit creepy and a little bit scary. But it also kind of captures the tone of the movie, which is just because somebody's a little bit creepy and a little bit alien doesn't mean they're not of value.
Right. So along the same theme of them being super bright on top of this mountain, during that entire sequence, as he is sort of being pursued through the woods by these government people led by Keyes, he is screaming at the top of his lungs the entire time. And it's like, wait, it's dark. There's there's underbrush. He's in the middle of the forest. He could hunker down somewhere. He's tiny. Instead, he's screaming at the top of his lungs and running as fast as he can.
Has it ever occurred to you, and I know it has, that E.T. is a child?
Well, so here, now we're going to get into probably my biggest issue with the movie in that regard. It doesn't entirely square to me, the whole thing here, right? Because we have this race of beings who are obviously super intelligent and advanced. They are capable of interstellar travel. They're obviously got here to Earth. They're clearly some sort of scientific something or other. They're botanists, paleo or exobotanists of some sort. But half the time, E.T., especially in the early scenes of the movie, sort of feels like he's pitched somewhere between a child and a pet, like a really smart dog or a like 5-year-old kid.
Yeah, I didn't get this until I was older. But and they don't make it 100% clear, but I'm pretty sure E.T. is a kid. Like, I think he's like a 10-year-old.
Well, so I looked this up a little bit. According to the novelization, he's 10 million years old.
What?
So maybe they age really, really slowly. Maybe in E.T. years, 10 million is like being six. I don't know. But he then later on in the movie is capable of cobbling together a bunch of electronics to build this machine that can communicate with his folks back home.
Right, right. Like, could an 8-year, it would be like an 8-year-old kid building a cell phone, right?
Right. There's also then the fact of like, you know, I think this is true whether he's a kid or not, but it's doubly true if he's a kid, which is that they leave him there. They're like, oh, well, he's being chased by some guys. We better get out of here. We're going to go ahead and shut the door. Let's go and let's leave him. And then the entire sort of movie after that is premised on this idea that he needs to phone home. Obviously, the most one of the most famous lines in pop culture history.
Can you say it right, please?
E.T. phone home.
Thank you.
Actually, he says E.T. home phone first, and then they repeat it back incorrectly.
No, I just like the way he says phone home.
Yeah, phone home. That he has to phone home to let them know to come back and get him. And they're like, wait, did they not, like, they realized that they left him there. Surely, if they didn't when they took off.
This is all just fun extrapolation of what we don't understand their language. Maybe they have this thing in plan that if one of us gets lost behind, you run and hide and call us and we'll come get you. We don't know. Maybe they were planning to come back in a year. Maybe they were hovering around the planet waiting for him. We don't know. We don't know of it. They just got scared and took off. Like Home Alone, they left the kid home.
Right. And what would be, if you left, like, what's the first thing that Catherine O'Hara did when she realized that she left the kid home?
She screamed in comedic fashion.
Right. And then spent the next 48 hours doing everything in her power to get back home again. Literally what happens here is that he phones home, tells them, hey guys, I'm still here. And they come back to the exact same place where they left him and pick him up. Which they could have just done. Like, why was that not the plan? Like, hey, you know what? If you get separated, come back in 24
hours. They had to run away because they were scared.
I understand that. But, like, why could they not come back 24 hours later and be like, all right, now we can pick you up again? Like, if I take my kids in public someplace, we have a plan usually where it's like, hey, if you get separated, meet over at, you know, the Mickey Mouse at the front of the entrance.
Like, these unanswered questions are part of what make the movie so interesting to me. There's a lot of movies in which unanswered questions would irritate me, but I trust Melissa Matheson, the screenwriter. I trust Spielberg in this film.
Yeah.
I'm fine with a lot of these unanswered questions. Okay, you know, the idea that how did nobody see this ship on top of a mountain? That's a fair question, and I could see why it would bug somebody. It's a fair question. But, like, this, you know, why didn't the aliens, or why did they, or why didn't they? Maybe they don't have emotions like we do, and they just thought, screw him.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah. No, I get it. So, scientifically, let's talk about a couple other things. Clearly, this is a problem with both of these movies. Not a problem, but it is an observation about both of these movies, which is obviously both of these sets of aliens are able to breathe compatible atmospheres with us. You know, E.T. does not ever need a spacesuit. He also eats our food.
I like how you said that. He eats our food. He was offered that food, Stephen. How dare you?
Well, I guess so. This is a perfect case in point, right? He's an alien who's, you know, of an interstellar alien species and capable of building a machine to communicate with his people back home.
Right.
But he falls for this trick where if you lead him along a trail with M&Ms on the ground, then he'll just pick them up and walk right into the trap, which is something a dog would do.
I want to ask you this. Aside from, like, the hand wavy stuff, which is, you know, the shorthand for the flower represents his life cycle, you know, like he can bring things back to life. So when the flower comes back to life, it indicates, you know, aside from that, I mean, like, what kind of hard factual science in this movie do you think there is, and does it work?
You know, the fact that he can digest our food, the fact that he can breathe our air, that's a thing that, like, right off the bat is, like, you kind of have to allow for in a science fiction movie, especially one like this. You don't want E.T. in a spacesuit the entire time. But at the same time, it's, from a scientific point, implausible to the point of being basically impossible.
Or they're so advanced that they only visit planets they know they can breathe on.
Yeah, but the fact that, you know, there wouldn't be any is point.
Okay. Now there, like, you go. That's a good answer.
Like, their biology has to be so closely compatible with ours for them to be able to digest our food for them and get any sort of, I mean, like, think about it this way, right? Like, if you ate the food that a cow eats, it would kill you.
Right. If I walked down the street and ate the first five things I saw on Earth.
Right. You would die.
First five organic things I saw.
Or you would get very, very sick. Right. And human beings are omnivores. We eat almost anything. Like, we eat the widest range of things of almost any species on Earth.
Dude, tonight I had two Pop-Tarts for dinner.
Right. And there are species like pandas and koalas that, like, subsist literally on one type of food and one type of food only. And so, you know, the interconnectedness of the biology is, from a scientific point, implies that we had to have come from some sort of common evolution. And again, even with that, like obviously we came from a common evolution with cows and goats, but there's a lot of things that they can eat that we can't. There's a lot of things that we can eat that they can't.
You just stumbled on a theme of ET that I don't know I've ever heard discussed before. The idea that ET and humans come from the same ancestor, and therefore that's why he has this connection with ET. Or with Elliot.
Yeah, well, there is a scientific theory called panspermia, which posits that it's possible that the building blocks of life did not start on Earth, but arrived on Earth via a comet or some other astronomical body that landed on Earth.
It's funny. I mean, it is the most basic thing in the world. Obviously, I'm sure I thought of the how could he breathe on Earth, but yeah, it never occurred to me. How does beer not like cut through his stomach and just burn a hole through his body?
There's another one. Right, exactly. Like, you know, beer... There's no reason to think that, you know, even if you get to digest our food, there's no reason to think that beer would make you intoxicated or make him intoxicated. Like,
and I think that's why a lot of this film delves into both the there is some, you know, obviously science fiction aspects to it, but yeah. It also delves more into, you know, fantasy. You know,
well, there's an interesting bit in a movie that I hope we're going to cover at some point, Alien Nation.
Yeah.
There's a bit in Alien Nation where the aliens get drunk off of expired milk.
Yeah, sour milk.
And alcohol does nothing to them. And so, yeah, for all we know, alcohol could be like turpentine to him, you know. It also then sort of, you know, once you establish that, once you say, okay, well, clearly his biology is close enough to ours that he can eat our food, he can get drunk off our beer, he can – he sounds like the world's worst house guest. He ate all our food, he got drunk off our beer, he's breathing our air, and now he's gotten sick with our diseases. And so, again, there's no real reason to believe that an alien disease would be compatible with ours. And, you know, there are a lot of – I mean, we talked about this when we talked about Contagion and Outbreak, that, you know, most diseases are very species specific. And even, you know, our close relatives of mammals, you know, diseases, you know, that will affect dogs, that won't affect human beings, that will affect pigs but not cows, you know. And so they're very sort of species specific.
Right. And ET just happens to be fortunate in that he catches a virus or what have you that kills him slowly. It's not something that just like he instantly inhales it and drops.
Well, what's not clear to me, you know, and I think it's maybe not meant to be clear, is who is sick and who was not, because they're empathically linked.
Well, I think the implication is clearly that the alien body is sick, because in one of the scariest sequences that I've ever seen in any film as a child, when they discover him in the creek and he's all pale and groaning, that is disturbing. Yeah. That is, and I know Spielberg did it that way on purpose. That is a really upsetting moment in the film.
Yeah, the sick ETs look really, really good. I will say that.
And is there any explanation as to why he recovers?
Because Elliot loves him or something.
Yeah,
I assumed, right? Like,
I don't know. Watching it as an adult, I think, oh, he got sick from something and then he recovered. Like, he got it, you know, like he had a bad fever.
No, but he didn't recover. He was dead. They froze him. They froze his body.
Well, we don't know his biology. Okay, so what you're saying is that Elliot's love literally brought a creature back to life is more believable than he wasn't fully dead?
I mean, yes, of course it does. Again, he was frozen solid at the time, so like...
Wait, but again, you know, we don't know what that freezing does to that biology. Maybe freezing is like medicine.
Well, so along those same lines... Like the scene prior to that scene where he's dead and they freeze him, they're attempting CPR on him and then using defibrillator paddles.
Yeah, I mean, who knows what electric charge could do to that body? It could make him turn 600 feet tall or blow up into dust. We don't know.
We don't have any idea how his heart works. Right. We don't have any idea. We don't even know where his heart, at that point in the movie, they don't even know where his heart is. Like, his heart could be in his head. His heart could be in his feet. Like, the idea that you would, like, do CPR and pump his chest and then do paddles on him as if he was, like, again, it's meant to be fantastical.
I don't, all I'm going to say is this, Steven, I don't like his feet. I know it's Gertie's line. It's maybe my favorite line in the whole movie because it kind of cuts through the treacle.
There was one cool moment that I liked from a scientific point of view where his eyes dilate, which was cool from a special effects point of view, but also from a scientific point of view, because that would absolutely evolve independently. Like, he would not have to be related to us in any way whatsoever for him to evolve a system whereby when things got very, very bright, his, you know, eyes would find some way to dim the light and then that they would get wider when things were dim. And there's a scene, and I don't know if you even noticed it, but there's a scene where he gets like a flashlight or whatever shined in his face, and his eyes, his pupils go zoop, and they get really, really, really small.
Yep.
Which, again, you don't have to posit any relationship with human beings or animals on Earth at all to realize
right. That. Right. It's just a natural instinct or a natural protection.
Almost any creature that evolved would evolve something like that. Yeah. And so I thought that was kind of cool.
I also, I don't know if this technically counts as science, but I fully respect E.T.'s skills of camouflage. When he hides in that closet full of stuffed animals,
So a couple, with like two or three more science points. The quarantine makes very little sense to me. So, okay, so first of all, how the quarantine begins, I'm completely flummoxed by. So they discover that E.T. is there, and they don't send people in hazmat suits or in, you know, in quarantine suits. They send in guys wearing a literal NASA emblazoned astronaut suits, which may, I don't like, it's such a, like, it's a cool visual. It makes no sense to me from a scientific point of view. Like, they could have just as easily had like the quarantine suits on that are completely sealed, and that would have worked just as well. But they wanted to do this astronaut theme with it, I guess. In the meantime, because they didn't want you to, like, you know, I figure they probably thought it would look a little bit ridiculous if you could see the guy's face in the astronaut suit, and they wanted it to be scary. So he has the visor down.
Yeah.
The gold visor. That visor is designed for direct sunlight in space. Like, you're standing on the moon and you're literally facing the sun.
Oh, yeah.
So it's more or less like a, you know, if you ever used an eclipse glass, like, that's how dark this thing is. You know, they walk into this dark house, they would just be tripping over things because they would literally not be able to see anything in the house at all with that visor down.
Okay. I think obviously the intent there is that they're meant to be faceless. And yeah. Spielberg says, all right, how can I do this? What kind of tint can I use? And they go, well, we use these in, all right, I want that.
Yep.
That looks great, yeah. Gold. But sir, that's not what we use. Nope, that's what we'll use.
Yeah, I mean, it's purely a visual statement. And, yep. You know, and it works, you know, because it is kind of scary and freaky and whatever else. Then they put them in this quarantine, and they build this whole quarantine thing inside their house. One of the things that seemed weird to me, clearly, like, the either Elliot got a disease from E.T. or E.T. got a disease from Elliot. They're both very, very sick. And they have, you know, in quarantine, they have them literally just next to one another, completely exposed to one another, which seems implausible to me that they would do. Mm-hmm. From a scientific point of view, they would have them in separate quarantines.
You might have a good theory on this. What would happen if I, in my Philadelphia neighborhood, found an alien, had it in my basement, and then the authorities found out? What would happen first? Like, you know what I mean? What would the procedure be?
I mean, I don't know that there's anything, you know, that there's any procedure in place for that, but I would imagine, yes, quarantining it.
Would they quarantine my entire neighborhood? Would they shut off the entire part of city of Philadelphia? What would they do?
It would depend on who you had interacted with. I mean, I would think the first thing that they would want to know is, where has the alien been? Where have you been? And that's sort of what they would start to do. So what they do in this movie is they quarantine them until Elliot gets better and E.T. dies. And then they're just like, all right, well, I guess we don't need to quarantine anymore. And they, like, break the whole thing down. And then they're just kind of hanging out around this dead alien that could have who knows what kind of pathogens in its system. And they're like, all right, yeah. Elliot, you can just kind of hang out near this
How
thing.
Twisted would that be if that's the ending, that E.T. dies? And not only that, but he starts to deteriorate immediately and gives off a toxic fume that invades the entire planet.
But the point is whatever it is, like, you wouldn't pick up a dead bird from your backyard. You'd be like, all right, well, if it's already dead, then it can't get me sick. Well, no, it can still very much get you sick.
Right.
And so they're like, all right, we don't have to do a quarantine anymore because E.T.'s dead.
Right. That thing's still fresh. What are you doing?
You know, and then they freeze it. You know, once they freeze it and stick it in the thing, you know, and close the lid, then you can say, okay, well, it's probably sealed off now. But they don't. Like, E.T.'s able to, like, I mean, not E.T., Elliot is able to just kind of, like, hang out by the side of this coffin thing. And pretend to cry and whatever else. And then, again, the last science thing that I will say is that, well, I did appreciate the fact that in both times that we saw the ship, both at the beginning and here at the end, there was a visible propulsion system. It was not, you know, there was not a mystery how this thing got off the ground. It had rocket cones, you know, nozzles basically around the perimeter of this big spherical ship. They were probably, you know, more powerful than when you think about what a rocket looks like. It's, you know, a tiny capsule on top of a giant fuel tank.
Right.
And there's no visible fuel tanks on this thing. But, you know, if it has some sort of propulsion system that's somehow way more efficient than ours, But you know, it kicks up dirt and it, you know, it's pushing against air to lift itself up, in contrast to a lot of alien things where it's just a saucer and there's some mysterious anti-gravity something something.
Right, and then it just slowly glides to the ground and feet come out and that's the end of
right.
it.
Right, yeah.
Well, I love this movie. It's an A. It's an A. Maybe not an A+, only because even though I do love the film, I don't feel that really personal connection to it. I don't know why exactly, because I was a little bit like Elliot, and my dad kind of bailed, and my mom was a superhero, and I have a cool sister, so I have a lot in common with this movie. But yeah, you know what? Screw it. A+. Done. Moving on.
it's an A-, maybe a B+ for me. I mean, I think it's one of those movies, again, that I've said several times, where like if you have to catch it at the exact right time of your life, and it didn't hit me at that right time. It was a little bit before my time. So I can appreciate absolutely everything that everybody loves about it, while at the same time, just, you know, it isn't a movie that I connected with on that level. Scientifically, C-.
I like that sound effect.
That's, you know, it's not, I've outlined all of the various different problems with it.
I think you would agree. Just sum it up, like, it's not a movie that's really, it's not a dumb movie when it comes to science, but it's not really all that interested in hard science, and that's fine.
Yeah, and it works, you know, because it has these fantastical elements. It's not trying to be hard science fiction, but it is just enough hard science fiction to sort of feel grounded. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't feel like a fantasy in the way that like Fifth Element completely throws all any scientific logic
right.
entirely to the wind. This, you know, tries to be somewhat grounded, you know, but at the same time, it's not going to let any of that stand in its way of telling the story that it wants to tell, and you know, more power to it for doing so.
Let us now flash forward 11 years, and we are now visited by a completely different type of alien. Steven, what is our second film?
We are going to be talking about a movie that, again, like you said earlier, is about as far away from E.T. as you can possibly get and still be in the same subgenre of movie. It is a movie that has one of the most terrifying sequences ever committed to film.
I've seen thousands of horror movies. I've seen more horror movies than you and your immediate family combined. I've seen horror movies from every country in the world. I've spent most of my life dedicated to the appreciation and documentation, curation, writing about horror films. I love horror films. Having said that, the last 10 or 12 minutes of this movie are drop dead freaking scary. They are.
It is one of the most frightening sequences I've ever seen in my life. Yes.
He's not exaggerating.
So we are talking, of course, about Fire in the Sky, which is a movie that is ostensibly based upon a true story. And I definitely want to get into that aspect of it. But the summary of it, the plot is actually quite simple. So according to this true story, a man named Travis Walton, who worked as a logger in the woods of Arizona in the 70s, he and six of his buddies were coming home from a hard day of logging and encountered what they all describe to this day as a flying saucer. He got out of the truck. The flying saucer blasted him with some sort of energy beam. The other five ran away as scared as possible, and then he disappeared for 5 days. And for 5 days, the entire town thought that they had murdered him. And it became a massive national news story. The police and the entire town formed massive search parties. They searched all through the woods. They found no evidence of him or of an alien craft or anything. And then 5 days later, bloop, suddenly he reappears by the side of the road at a payphone. He's malnourished. He is naked, I believe. And, in the movie he's naked. I don't think he was actually naked in real life. And he has a fantastical story to tell about being abducted by aliens.
Yeah, and you know, this is an interesting movie because to me it raises the issue of what we can call fiction and nonfiction.
Yep.
If somebody truly believes that something happened to them and they are not lying and you don't suspect them as being just a bullshitter just to make a nickel, if somebody truly believes that something happened to them, that's nonfiction, right?
Sort of. It's a fascinating story. So, yeah. Well, I want to get into that, and I want to get into all of the, you know, I think it's a very, like, I, you know, an amateur, I guess, UFO skeptic. You know, I don't, obviously, I will just come right out and say I don't think he was actually abducted by aliens. I think that's clearly of all of the possibilities here.
Are we in agreement that let me give you my theory on UFOs, and you'll tell me if you agree. I definitely believe that there is intelligent life out there other than us. Definitely, definitely, definitely. I do not believe that they have ever visited this planet.
It is extremely unlikely. And we've talked about this, I think, in other episodes, so I won't belabor the point. But the distances between star systems are vast on a scale that it's almost impossible for human beings to comprehend. And there's a speed limit to the universe. And that speed limit is the speed of light. And so to get to the nearest star from us would take 4 years at the speed of light. It would take more like 10,000 years at a speed that we can even possibly imagine achieving, and hundreds of thousands of years at the fastest speed that any human beings have ever sent anything out into space. If we are ever going to have any sort of interstellar travel, it will be because we've built arcs, that we've built entire civilizations that then go on to some other place. The idea that like there is aliens just kind of zipping around and flying saucers and showing up and probing rednecks in the butt is just it's not true.
I don't want us to get into like sitcom shtick here because, you know, respect the story and all that. But if you were able to gather all of that, you know, technical know-how and fuel and skill and whatever, and be able to visit a distant planet, why would your first step be to grab one of the creatures and put things in its ass?
Well, and even if it was, I mean, I can see some, you know, I read an analogy one time that really sort of struck with me, which was like that a fish, you imagine a fish, you know, swimming along in the ocean, and he sees a littler fish, you know, flapping around, and he goes, oh, there's a nice easy meal, and he bites it, and all of a sudden there's massive pain in his mouth, and he gets yanked up out of the water into this world that he never even knew existed, you know, and he finds himself on a boat flopping around or whatever else, and then, you know, these strange creatures go and they, you know, really, really hurt him, you know, and he starts bleeding out of his mouth, and then suddenly they just throw him back into the water and to go about his fish business, right? Like a fish would have no way to contextualize that experience. Now, obviously, fishes are a lot less intelligent than human beings are. But, you know, there's a sense in which if there were aliens coming and they were studying us for some reason that was only, you know, known to them, we might not ever even be able to figure out, you know, what their motivation might be.
Dude, that is chilling. And I think you and I have to start a screenplay called Fish Trauma. That, I mean, good Lord. No, but you're right. It's like just because there are other realities to that, like that fish doesn't know that the world above the surface exists, but it does.
Right. And has no way to figure out what the motivations of, you know, that he has no way to know that those fishermen were just kind of going out and doing this for fun and then throwing the fish back in just because, the you know, or, you know, because they were having a contest to see who could catch the biggest one or whatever. Like there's no way for that fish to ever contextualize that experience in a way that would make sense to its fish brain.
Well, I know that you've done a lot of research on this, and we're going to get to the true story or the allegedly true story behind the movie. But we'll just cover the movie real quick. It is a 1993 release. It is a good, solid cast of good, cool character actors like Robert Patrick, D.B. Sweeney, the great, late, great James Garner, and Craig Sheffer, who's not so great but is memorable at least for being not a good actor. and it's presented, and now I can't remember the titles off the top of my head, but I know you saw these as a kid, late 70s to like mid 80s, either TV movies or TV specials about alien abduction. Right. There were countless, and this one feels like obviously they hired a real DP and they put some money into production design because it looks nice. It doesn't look like a CBS movie of the week, but structurally and script-wise, it feels like a 1979 CBS Tuesday night movie of the week.
Sort of, yes and no. Obviously that, you know, that the 20-minute sequence on the alien ship, you know, completely makes that not true anymore.
Oh, yeah. I'm talking about for the first hour of the film. It's almost entirely boilerplate.
Yes and no. I mean, I feel like they made some interesting creative choices. I don't know how many of them work entirely, but so the structure of it struck me this time. They don't start with the alien abduction, right? There's a lot of ways you could have structured this story. The way they structure it is kind of how it unfolded to the people that are, you know, were nearby in the town. And specifically, they have Robert Patrick and his friends go to this bar, they call the police, James Garner and the other cop come, and he has to tell them the story of what happened. And then so now we're technically flashing back, but we may not be flashing back. We may just be hearing his version of events. And then the movie kind of plays out for the next hour or so around this idea of like Maybe these guys are lying. Maybe they're telling the truth. We as the audience didn't see this stuff occur. We saw his narration of what happened. Does that make sense?
Right. The movie opens with this: the main characters bailing ass down a mountain in a pickup truck and then explaining to somebody what happened.
Right.
And that to me feels like a very network movie structure, because when you come back from the flashback and Garner is standing there skeptically, now it's time for a commercial. You know?
But, right. But my point is that it's structured that way, I think, for a reason, because this story, the true story, really sort of mirrors that skepticism that James Garner's character obviously has, you know, where, okay, we only have these guys' word for it about what happened. And we as the audience, too, also only have these guys' word for it about what happens. And so one of the interesting choices that they made, which I don't think fully works, but it's fascinating to me. So when I think about this movie and I think of who the lead character of this movie is, before I rewatched it this week, it was D.B. Sweeney, because of that whole sequence at the end of the movie. But if you actually watch the movie from the beginning, for the first half of the movie, for the entire time that D.B. Sweeney is missing, Robert Patrick is the main character of this movie. We see things entirely through his point of view. Now, you could have easily made it the sheriff's point of view, where you would have then had the audience skeptical towards these guys, you know, or you could have had us see it from Robert Patrick's point of view from the very beginning, so we knew that he was telling the truth. But instead, they try to ride this sort of weird middle ground where it's like,
plus we've all seen the poster and we know what the story is. So therefore, even though it's a fairly, you know, it's a serviceable structure, we all know where it's going. They didn't kill him.
But again, like, we know that they didn't kill him. Yes, that is true. But we do not know whether or not they made this whole story up. And to this day, we don't know whether or not they made this whole story up. There are lots of reasons why they might have. There are reasons to believe that they didn't, that at least some of them absolutely believe that it happened to them. But
I do give the film credit for being sober about it. They're not treated as dumb, you know, ignorant. You know, like, one of them's kind of an asshole, but they're not treated like morons. They're treated like, you know, intelligent guys who cut down trees. Yeah. They're not crackpots or loonies, and that is a good part of the script.
One of the problems with this structure is that there are several scenes during that first stretch where it is just the guys alone talking to one another. So it's, you know, two or three or all of them together talking about what happened. And because the movie doesn't really want the audience to know whether they're lying or not, they talk to one another in sort of almost Cody kind of way of like, oh, well, you saw exactly what happened. Oh, I did see what happened. And it was, you know, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, and so they even when they're talking amongst themselves, never either confirm, you know, they never say, dude, we saw an alien ship. It actually came down. Oh, I know. I remember that alien ship. I saw it, you know, which if they were amongst themselves, you would believe them.
There are these vague conversations that kind of talk around it instead of me going, Steven, we both felt the heat on our faces. Right. We both saw the red lights, right?
Exactly. Right. And so when they talk about vague things like, oh, you know exactly what happened, that could either refer to an alien ship came down, or it could refer to we killed our friend and buried him in the woods.
Right. It's that not subtle ambiguity, right?
Right. And it doesn't really make sense for these people to be talking about this amongst themselves in that way. But the movie kind of puts itself in that bind to do that.
But overall, I think it's not a bad script. I just think there's not a lot of meat to this story aside from this guy is convinced he was abducted. These guys obviously believe him because they didn't kill him. And then we get to experience what he goes through. And I think the first hour or so is interesting, passable, watchable, not terrible, but ultimately get to the point. And then when it does,
maybe, but yeah.
It is one of the most horrifying sequences you'll ever see in a movie. It is great.
Truly.
It is just great.
Yeah, no. And again, I think that the movie, poster aside, I think that you have to tell the story this way, right? You have to tell it in a way that, like, it unfolds as this mystery. And even if you know, you know, you have to, there's a sense in which when you're writing a story, you can't, like, assume that the audience has, you know, is intimately familiar with the true story already, or, you know, otherwise there's no point in telling it, right?
Oh, I know what you're saying. Like, you couldn't just open the movie with him telling the story about the abduction.
You have to build to that, right? Because nothing can follow that, and the movie knows that. Like, it gets to the point where he tells his story of what happened to him, and then there's a tiny little, like, 10-minute epilogue of 3 years later or whatever with Robert Patrick and a terrible fake beard.
What a bad epilogue
is. And him and D.B. Sweeney kind of, like, making up a little bit. But I want to talk about this true story a little bit because I have done a bunch of research on it in the past, and then I actually stumbled across a thing last night that I had not seen before, which is an episode of a show called Paranormal Witness, which I believe was aired or may be still airing on Sci-Fi. It's not a show that I had ever heard of before, but I was able to download this particular episode from iTunes, and it is, you know, in between cheesy, bad, dramatic reenactments. It is interviews with all of the principal guys except for Craig Schaefer's character. Now, like recently, I think it was 2012 that this episode came out. And so they're all older dudes now talking about this thing that happened 30, 40 years ago and sticking to their stories. Like I went into this episode thinking, okay, these guys, you know, based on the evidence that I've seen and read, they're full of crap. There is, you know, evidence that Travis Walton was super into UFOs prior to this. There was an episode of a television show about what is considered the first quote-unquote alien abduction that aired 2 weeks before this supposedly happened to Travis Walton. And those people were definitely full of crap.
I've done a little bit of research. Yeah. You did a lot more. I dug into mainly Wikipedia, and it brought me to that movie, The UFO Incident with James Earl Jones, and I thought – I doubt I saw it, but it sounds vaguely familiar. Yep.
And a lot of the stuff that happens in this movie was absolutely true in terms of like them talking to the police and passing lie detector tests and the hypnotic regression, which I want to get into the science of that a little bit. Both of those things, both the lie detectors and hypnotic regression. I have some choice words on those things.
Good.
But no, like I walked into that episode feeling like, okay, these guys were full of crap. I walked out of that watching these interviews with these guys now 30 years later, and either they're the Oscar-level actors now still, or they believe that something happened to them. Travis Walton, I'm not as sure about. Watching him talk, I feel like he's probably full of crap, and he might have pulled a fast one on all of these other guys in some way or another. But those other guys absolutely believe that they saw an alien spacecraft.
Oh, that's an interesting theory. I never even thought of that because I did read that he was into UFO stories before this happened. But the idea that maybe he set up some kind of wildly elaborate bolt to scare the hell out of them and then set up his lie.
That was one of the leading theories for a long time, was that he and Mike, the guy played by Robert Patrick, set this whole thing up somehow. Watching those interviews with the modern day, with Mike, the actual Mike now, He breaks down and cries at one point talking about how traumatic this experience was for him. And it's possible that he's crying about, you know, having pulled the wool over people's eyes and he's feeling guilty about it, maybe. I don't know. But it certainly feels like he's genuinely has some genuine emotions about. And so I don't know what to believe anymore. I unequivocally do not believe that they were abducted by aliens. Like that to me is the one thing that I can rule out definitively. And so then it comes down to like, well, these people genuinely believed that they went through some sort of experience. And, you know, and we know from the UFO literature, from lots of accounts from different people, there are a lot of different ways in which people are susceptible to believing that normal astronomical phenomena or atmospheric phenomena or various other things are or could only possibly be explained by aliens. And I'm going to tell you a little bit of a story right here. I am a professional astronomer, obviously, or was in a previous life. I was at McDonald Observatory, which is one of the darkest places in the country. I was standing outside smoking a cigarette because I was still dumb enough to do that back then. And I saw this light dancing around on the horizon. And it was changing colors and moving around. And it was turning red and green and yellow and just kind of dancing around on the horizon. And I sat there for probably a good 30 seconds to a minute going, you know, and again, because I'm a scientist, I knew that it was not an alien ship, but I'm sitting there looking at this going, I can't figure out what the heck this thing is. I don't know what that is that's doing that out there. It took me a couple of minutes to finally realize what was happening, which was that a star was super, super low in the sky. And when something is that low in the sky, normally, you know, you can't see those things in a city because there's light pollution. And if you look low in the sky, you just see a haze of light from all the streetlights and whatever else in the city. I was out at a place that was dark enough where I could actually see stars super low on the horizon. And when you're looking at a star that low on the horizon, you're looking through like 3 or 4 times as much air as you would if you were looking at it overhead, because you're basically looking through the, you know, you're looking through the atmosphere long ways instead of...
You're looking off in the... You're not looking directly up. You're looking off in the distance.
Right. If you're looking off in the distance, you're looking through a whole lot of air before that light reaches
right.
you.
And okay,
so what happens is if there's turbulence in the air, and this is a thing that's called seeing in astronomy. You say like, oh, the seeing is good. The seeing is bad. The seeing is X number of arc seconds. And it's a thing that we have to account for when we're actually taking astronomical observations. But when you are looking at it, something through that much atmosphere, the atmosphere bounces around and the light that's coming from that star before it reaches your eye gets refracted a bunch of
times. Right. It's almost like trying to figure out how many filters you're looking through to get to the object.
Well, no, it's more like, you know, if somebody was hanging out at the bottom of a pool and you see like 3 different images of them and it kind of bounces around because the waves are, you know, there are waves in the pool and
right.
and as they move around, it looks like he's kind of jumping around a little bit and moving to different places. It's not like that. It is that. It's exactly that same phenomenon. And so that was what was happening with this star. And I just remember being struck in that moment by like, if I was not a trained astronomer and I went out and I saw exactly what I just saw, I absolutely could totally see how I would be fooled into thinking that was a spaceship and it was
bam.
It was moving way faster than any, you know, any terrestrial spaceship could ever possibly move, and it was changing colors and it was moving around and zipping this way and that way.
It's one of my favorite cliches. A little knowledge is a dangerous thing.
Yeah.
Because you have enough knowledge to know that that is odd and it's not moving right, and your brain, if you're not trained in this area, your brain immediately jumps to, that's definitely an alien ship about to land in the desert. Holy crap. And if you were trained, you could be like, well, no, there's like a dozen different things that could be.
Right. And, you know, one of the most common things to be mistaken for a UFO is the planet Venus. And it's especially true of pilots. And for some reason in the UFO literature, like, they love pilots. People are like, oh, he was an airline pilot, so he's really, really trustworthy. And it's like, an airline pilot is no more or less, or a military pilot, it's no more or less
fallible.
Susceptible to,
right.
Both A, fallible, and B, capable of believing weird, crazy stuff. But, you know, a number of times we've been able to definitively show that, like, this guy who was flying a fighter jet thought that some sort of light, you know, was pacing him and flying. And when he turned, it turned. And when he turned back the other way, it turned back the other way. And then it was following him. And it's literally one of the things that my son says when we're driving along and we see either Venus or the moon. Oh, the moon is following us, Mama and Dada. And that's what it feels like, because obviously the moon is not going to, you know, as you move, the moon is so far away that it seems like it's always exactly in the same spot. And so if your brain sort of tricked you into thinking that whatever this light was, it was a couple hundred yards away and moving at the exact same speed as you, then, you know, you could absolutely see how you go, okay, well, the only thing that could possibly do that is some sort of alien craft. And it takes realizing, oh, you know what, that thing is actually millions of miles away, and it's just the reason why it looks like it's just moving along with me. And so that is one of the things that gets mistaken a lot for a UFO, particularly by pilots, because if you don't have any reference point, if you can't see trees and buildings moving past, then it just literally just looks like this light is following you.
All right, Stephen, give me a scientific pro and a scientific con on hypnosis.
I mean, hypnosis as a relaxation technique, as a visualization technique, great. I've done it before. It's, you know, very relaxing. It's very, you know, it's a thing that you can do. It's meditative. But as far as hypnotic regression or the kind of hypnosis that they're doing in here where they're like, he doesn't remember a thing, and then a hypnotist goes and says, oh, you know, tell me what really happened, and he then remembers a bunch of stuff that he didn't remember before. That's been fairly definitively shown to be complete and utter garbage. In fact, the exact opposite is almost always what happens. There have been experiments that show that you can implant memories that definitively never happened into people. There's an experiment called the Lost in the Mall experiment, where this psychology researcher got a bunch of people in, including children, to come in and convince them that this anecdote about how they once got lost in the mall and separated from their parents was true. And like 25% of them, years and years later, still 100% believe that they got lost in the mall, even though it was a made-up story that she implanted in their brains and got. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, I do believe that memory can be a really tricky thing. I believe that, you know, you have a memory of like a nugget of getting lost in the mall, and then around that nugget, in which you might have lost your mom for literally 30 seconds. And now around that memory, you've built all these annexes that didn't happen. Oh, the security guard didn't listen to me. And then I went to the movie theater and, you know, you just build all these little structures around the true nugget.
And in that experiment, that's exactly what happened, is that people started filling in details. Like the story was very sort of vague, and she allowed the people to fill in their own details about what had happened. And people started filling in their own details that they were then suddenly spontaneously remembering. And again, years later, the most vivid things still in their memory were the details that they had made up to add to the story. It wasn't the things that she had told them. And so this is a thing that happens. It happened, you know, in the 90s, tragically in a lot of ways, because there was this whole like satanic panic and people recovering repressed memories of abuse and trauma, and then pointing fingers at people that absolutely did not deserve it because, you know, some therapist had, especially with children, had implanted suggestions in their brain of things that didn't ever actually happen, and destroyed numerous people's lives. And it is one of those things where now, like, no mainstream psychologist really believes that recovering traumatic memories is a thing that actually happens. It's the opposite. It's you implant via suggestibility.
Okay. So, but I also find it interesting that, because some people think hypnosis is just straight up garbage, straight up nonsense.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, it's, you know, like I said, I have been hypnotized before. It's not what you think it is. It's not, you know, it's a matter of, it's a type of guided meditation. It's not like, oh, well, now I can, like, you know, I can tell you to go jump up and down on one foot and you'll jump up and down on one foot.
Steven, you know, make me a sandwich.
Like, that kind of hypnosis is not real. But there is a type of hypnosis, hypnotherapy, that is essentially just a type of meditation.
Interesting. All right. So what about the lie detector process?
Well, so, you know, the other aspect of this story that I find fascinating. So I was going to say, like, you know, it's possible that these guys have filled in all of these memories, right? That something, there was, like you said, there was some kernel of a thing that happened, and it's possible that it was perpetrated by Travis Walton or one of the, or him in concert with one of the other guys or with his brother or whatever. And, you know, that they experienced something, and in the heightened fear of that moment, they, you know, it's solidified into this memory of, oh, that, you know, I saw a ship and I saw it and it was 10 feet wide and it was, you know, beaming a light out and whatever else, that, you know, that their brains have filled in a lot of these details, and that those now are genuine memories that these people have, even though they're not true. And so you would absolutely be able to pass a lie detector test if you believed that that was true.
Yeah. Is it a lie detector, or is it like, am I detecting a lie in you, or am I detecting what you believe is true? If you truly believe that an alien jumped on your back and rode you through the mall, and then I throw you in a lie detector test, it won't catch that it didn't really happen. All it will say is he believes it.
Right. Well, so there's the other scientific aspect of that, of quote unquote lie detector tests. So obviously there is not such a thing as a lie detector test. It's called a polygraph. And what it does is it measures three different aspects of your, what's called your autonomic nervous system. And those things are things that you aren't necessarily directly under your control. And so what it's measuring is not whether you're telling a lie or not. It is measuring whether or not you are stressed out by whatever the question was, or, you know, in some sense, generally, more generally, stressed out by what's happening. They are extremely controversial because there's very little actual science behind them. They are highly dependent on who is delivering the test and what their methodology is. And even then, they are relatively easy to beat.
Right. If you were told, if you truly, honestly just get it into your head that you didn't steal that diamond, the machine won't catch it.
Well, no, actually what you do is the opposite, right? So it is the only way that they can tell what is a normal and not normal reaction to you is they ask a bunch of control questions. So they ask you, you know, is your name Scott Weinberg? And,
yes.
And they tell you to lie on some of them and tell the truth on some of them. And so that way they try to establish, quote, you know, quote unquote, establish a baseline for what it looks like when you tell the truth or when you tell a lie.
Okay.
Right? They ask you control questions and they can say, you know, okay, well, is your name Scott Weinberg? You're not going to be stressed out answering that, but then you're going to be stressed out answering, Scott, did you murder your friend in the woods?
Right.
If you actually murdered your friends in the woods, then that question will stress you out.
But I'm sorry, even if I didn't, that question would still make me nervous.
Well, there's part, that's right, that's part of it.
Or if my baseline, if you ask me 40 questions and the lines all look the same, and then you throw in one curveball and I go, and all the lines start to jerk, that means something. right?
It does. It can mean lots of different things.
Doesn't mean I'm guilty, but it means something.
Right. It can mean that you're worried that they're going to think you're guilty. And so you're stressed out answering that question because they might think that you're lying. And that alone could potentially be enough to make you look like you're lying.
Which is why they're inadmissible as court evidence.
Right, exactly. What's harder to imagine is an experienced polygraph technician. Like I said, they're relatively easy to beat. Most polygraph technicians know the strategies that people are going to try in order to beat them, and they can counter against that, or they'll then declare the test inconclusive. Because again, the goal there is to make yourself look stressed out even when you're answering questions that you're not stressed out by. It's not to make yourself not be stressed out
right.
when you're lying.
Right.
It's to just make everything look, so that they can't tell the difference. And that's usually fairly easy to do. What's harder to do is to just be cool as cucumber the whole way
right.
through.
It's easier to force nervousness than it is to fake innocence.
Right. And so, but what is very difficult to imagine is that these five guys who had clearly would not have had any sort of training, especially not in 1975, any sort of training on how to beat a lie detector test or any sort of, even premonition that they might be called on to take one, for them to all get flying colors immediately, like while Travis Walton was still missing, any one individual person might be able to beat the lie detector that way for all five of them to, is really difficult to imagine unless, obviously, the person administering the lie detector test was crappy at their job for some reason.
Was full of crap. Right.
Right.
Okay.
So there was a game show on Fox a couple of years back called The Moment of Truth. The premise of the show was that they actually had people hooked up to a lie detector live on television, and they were asking them questions about these things that they were famous for or whatever. And so, I asked him if he had ever been abducted by a UFO, and he said yes. And according to the lie detector examiner there, he was being deceptive. His response to that was, well, lie detectors aren't 100% reliable. I was like, well, okay, well, then how can you use them to exonerate? Like,
yeah.
The earlier tests, you're claiming,
And right.
Then,
when it works in your favor, it's right. semi-believable. It's but when right. it doesn't work in your favor, it's exactly. definitely not believable.
What makes the situation even more fraught is that a prominent UFO skeptic named Philip Klass discovered in the 90s that there was an earlier one, like right after he was supposedly, dropped back off. The National Enquirer and this UFO society administered a lie detector test to him with the stipulation that they would keep the results secret if he wasn't telling the truth. And according to that examiner, which was a couple days after he came back, he was completely full of crap.
Huh.
And they they kept it secret for 10 or 20 years or whatever, and then somebody discovered that this thing actually existed, and then they all said, oh, well, we kept it secret because we thought that that polygraph examiner had it out for him and was asking him questions that he shouldn't have been asking him and blah, 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 blah. So it was that same sort of like, oh, well, that one wasn't valid. But the one he took a couple weeks later after he'd had a chance to prepare and after he'd been paid $5,000 by the National Enquirer, that one was true, but the one that he took immediately afterward wasn't true because the examiner was out to get him, which, to be completely honest, that's, I would think that a good polygraph examiner, that's part of what your job is.
Right, but couldn't you just now say, all right, fine, let's call the polygraphs a complete wash. One of them said yes, the other said no, so let's just throw them all out the window. On the face of your story, I don't believe it. I don't believe it. Let's jump into the sequence that everybody talks about. Love or hate this movie, you will spend some time talking about the sequence in which the D.B. Sweeney, the Travis Walton character, has a right. breakdown at a party. He climbs under a table, he loses it, and then we get I think it's 9 or 9.5 minute sequence of his experience, his memory on the ship. And I mentioned earlier that even when it's just in TV movie mode, this movie is gorgeously shot. And
right.
I want to just mention, it's especially gorgeously shot in this scary sequence. Bill Pope, who got his start with Sam Raimi on Darkman, and then went on to do stuff like, well, obviously Fire in the Sky, and then he did the Matrix sequels. He shot Spider-Man 2. He shot Scott Pilgrim and The World's End. This guy's a top-notch visual effects, action, and DP in general, Bill Pope. So, all right, he wakes up in this thing, and I think why this sequence is so memorable is not just because it's extended, scary, and unique. It's because it introduces kind of a new look to an alien spaceship that we hadn't really seen before. Yeah. In a lot of these alien abduction stories, but they wake up on a bed or everything is silver and shiny, looks like Logan's Run. And in this, it looks like what would be like an alien ship's garbage disposal.
Yeah, the ship itself, you can tell even earlier on when they first encounter the ship, it's this very organic thing. It looks like it has veins and it's like pulsating and whatever else. That UFO and this sequence were where the filmmakers took the most creative license. The actual story that Travis Walton told when he got back bore very little resemblance to the way it's depicted in this movie. That was probably the least faithful part of the entire movie was the actual experience that he had. The actual story that he tells is way less believable than what we see him do on the screen. But yeah, no, like I love the organic, like he wakes up in what essentially feels like a cell of a hive.
Cocoon almost, right?
Right, right. He bursts out of this membrane thing and he's just one of many, many cells along this wall, and he makes his way along the wall and he puts his hand through a corpse that's there,
and you can't really tell which perception is there for gravity. At first it looks like he's sinking and then he's rising. He's connected to this cord. He pulls on it and it really, honestly, I'm like, as you know, I think creatively speaking, this sequence feels like somebody tapped into a nightmare.
Oh yeah. It's again, the production design, the way that it's shot, the sound design, like all of it is just so spectacular. One of my favorite moments of this sequence, which has nothing to do with the horror of it, is when he encounters the spacesuits. And he encounters these aliens that look like the way that we sort of traditionally depict what they call the grays in UFO literature, which is the pick-shaped head, the guitar pick-shaped head, and the big black almond eyes that you sort of think of when you think of alien, you think of Roswell aliens and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, the most old school stereotype version of the alien visitor.
And then this movie says, you know what, those are the spacesuits that the aliens wear. And I thought that was a neat touch.
Yes. Yeah, very good point. Yep, glad you mentioned that. That's interesting too. It's like, that's the explanation, is that why would people all over the planet report the similar looking aliens? Oh, it's because that's their traveling suit. Neat.
Yeah, well, I mean, it answers the question that we had about the last movie, which is, the aliens, it's hard to imagine aliens that would be capable of breathing in our atmosphere. And, if you posit that all of these sightings, these alleged sightings of aliens that humans have had over the last 50 years that describe the same type of creature, and how would this creature just be sitting around in our atmosphere? Well, this answers that question. It's because they're not. They're in a spacesuit. And every time human beings have seen them prior to this moment, they were in these spacesuits. And so we thought that that's what the aliens looked like, but that's not. It would be like somebody thinking that Neil Armstrong looked like a big white marshmallowy thing with a visor.
Yeah, good point. And so what I find interesting is that, yes, this movie does get into, let's accept the theory that if an alien species were to visit here and one of their first instincts would be find the leading or the most dominant biological species and run some experiments on it. Okay,
yep.
That it makes sense, I suppose, sure. That's what we would do if we discovered an alien worm. We would have to test it and see what it does and what makes it tick. Now, that makes sense, and this is far and away the most horrifying cinematic rendition of that.
Yeah, it's just from beginning to end, it's like the filthiness of it, the disgust factor, like right from the beginning, like he's in this disgusting environment.
Yeah, no, I'm talking about like once they drag him down the hall, which is horrifying because they give you little clues that he's not the first human to be there on the ship.
Right.
And once they strap him down and the visuals of that like latex sheet. Ugh. Oh,
and then they
God.
Put the gross, like black slime stuff in his mouth.
Yep. Then they cut the sheet over one eye and his mouth, and it taps into all of these fears we have of not just claustrophobia, but the medical procedures and choking. And it's not a horror movie, but it's one of the most horrifying sequences I've ever seen.
Here's the thing about it, right? It's hard to imagine what any of that stuff. It doesn't make any sense on one level of like, okay, well, are these aliens just examining us with dirty equipment? Are they only interested in eyeballs and mouths? It's hard to fathom what they're doing.
It's like, why are they throwing this black goo into his mouth? Would be like an alien saying, well, wait, why are they putting that IV in his arm? You know, to us, it would be like, well, that's how we give them the fluids they need.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, that's the thing, right? And that's one of the things that makes it so scary. Like, you can imagine a version of this scene by a filmmaker that's less interested in and horrifying in this moment. And it's much more about, you know, a clinical setting. Oh, they're in, it's a very white place and it's very clean and they're doing things that are, you know, that are.
Right. And it's a gray standing there with a clean scalpel.
Right. They're very obviously doing medical experiments. Like, this is clearly obviously some sort of medical experiment, but it's so alien that it's impossible to even imagine what it is that they're actually attempting to accomplish. Like, you can't even wrap your brain around what it is that this is even supposed to do. And
is it a fair criticism of the film that this sequence is so effective and fascinating that the film suffers by not having more of it throughout the rest of the movie?
I mean, like I said, I think you needed to have it at the climax, and I think they knew that. I think that it's the thing that almost everybody remembers about it. Like I said, I always thought that D.B. Sweeney was the protagonist of this movie, but he's not, or at least not for the first half. And it's because of this scene is so much from his very subjective point of view. But no, I mean, like, it would wear off very sort of quickly. It's one of the reasons why it's so effective, I think, is because the whole first half of the movie is this very grounded, like, okay, did it happen? Did it not really happen? Are these guys telling the truth? Is it a lie? The lie detectors and blah, blah, blah.
Right. And then you're delivering the punchline.
Right. And then you're like, okay, well, you know, now we've established that this is a real thing. Again, it's based on a true story. It's a real thing that happened in the real world that you and I inhabit. And then you throw this thing at them that people are not expecting at all, that is horrifying beyond belief. And, you know, it's a gut punch of a scene. And that horror exists not just because of how effective that scene is done, but because of how effective the movie is around
it. Yeah, no, I think it's a fair point. If they peppered in little bits of horror, it might have made the film overall a bit more punchy, but it would have sucked some of the effectiveness from the final sequence.
Yeah, it would have made you feel more like you were watching a movie as opposed to a documentary or a docudrama, a movie about a true story.
Well, I want to throw some credit to the director, Robert Lieberman. Started in 1980 with a Tom Skerritt revenge thriller called Fighting Back, shot in Philly. Then he did a kind of bland John Voight melodrama called Table for Five. He did All I Want for Christmas, 91. And after this, he directed D3, The Mighty Ducks, before moving on to a ridiculously voluminous career in television, particularly, like hundreds and hundreds of hours of television.
So scientifically, we do still have the problem of the breathable atmosphere, because he is on this ship, and he's clearly in some sort of zero-gravity environment, and he's able to breathe on this ship, and they are able to breathe. They're not wearing the spacesuits when he finally encounters them. And so there's clearly some sort of, you know, he's able to breathe on this spaceship, which, again, that to me speaks a lot towards my having a hard time believing this or any alien abduction story.
To a layman, I don't think it's not that unbelievable that they could set the ship so that he could breathe on it. What I find as a know-nothing, what I find hard to believe is that he could be in the same room and they could both withstand the same type of atmosphere or chemicals.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And if you read his actual story, the medical exam part of it is actually a very small part of it. And then he escapes, he brandishes something as a weapon and they all back away and he escapes and he ends up in the cockpit of the ship and he's able to he starts playing with levers. This is the true story, or the quote true story that he expects people to
believe. Doesn't the film then just cut away and he's in a field?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the film doesn't ever explain how or why he was released, which is also a problem with his true story and a problem, again, I feel like with any alien abduction story. I feel like if you are going to fly millions of light years to study these other creatures, it's hard to imagine any plausible scenario where you would let them go so that they could go tell everybody else that aliens exist.
Right. Or even just take it bigger than that. Why would you have morality if we traveled to another planet and found a ringworm? Would we have the morality to, hey, make sure you leave it here. Don't bring it home and study it. No, you can't. No, they wouldn't care. We're scientific specimens. Right. That's all we are.
Right. Right, exactly. And so you can't imagine a scenario where they'd be like, all right, well, we can take these people and we can study them, but then we have to release them and somehow erase their memories so that they can only be, under hypnosis will they recall the situation.
Right. Plus the film clearly indicates that other humans died on this ship. So why did they let this one go?
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Well, so why did they let him go? And, you know, the movie cleverly sidesteps that question. It doesn't try to show him trying to escape or whatever, because, again, it's impossible to imagine a scenario where he could actually escape. He's on an alien ship. There could be, you know, halfway to Venus at that point, or they could be hovering a couple hundred yards, you know, a couple hundred miles above the ground. But either way, he's not getting out of that ship. There's no way a human being is getting out of that ship by, you know, plucky wherewithal, you know.
Oh, you know what? That's a good point. They never make it clear that the ship could be literally hiding invisibly on a mountain in Arizona, or it could be halfway to Venus, like you said, or it could be, yeah, it could be anywhere. It doesn't mean it's deep in space.
Right. But it's probably not on the ground. And if it was, you know, and well, you know, and again, in his true account, when he does finally wake up, he wakes up by the side of the road and the ship is hovering above him, and it takes, you know, it lifts off into the space or whatever.
I've always wanted to ask a space expert this kind of question. Of the people who report, say, let's go back to like 1975 forward, okay? Or no, let's go Roswell forward, okay?
Yep.
What percentage of the people who have reported UFOs were A, bullshitting, B,
mistaken,
thought they saw something truly sincere, but were wrong,
right?
And C, maybe did see something literally inexplicable?
I mean, you know, one of the, I think we should close with this, because one of my favorite pieces of alien debunking was also comes from the same guy, Philip Klass, that I talked about earlier. You know, there are people that think that they saw aliens, and for every, especially for the high profile cases, you know, there are a lot of scientists and scientific minded people who, you know, for lack of a better term, are called debunkers. Who will call themselves skeptics. And if you start from the premise that, okay, there aren't actually aliens here, then it's like, okay, well, what is the explanation? And like you said, there are generally three possibilities. They're making it up. They believe it, but it didn't really happen. Or something happened to them and they have misinterpreted it. I don't know what the exact percentages are. I do know that if you look through, like even UFO enthusiasts will admit that the vast majority of these stories are either, you know, people who are full of crap or people who have misinterpreted things that we can easily explain.
I need to interject this.
Yeah.
Is it ufologist or ufologist? And where does one get a degree in ufology?
From the University of Full of Crap.
From the University of Shrootbucks.
I've only ever read it. I don't hang out in ufologist. I would say ufologist.
I know, but you know, you love science and you love space and science.
Yeah, but again, I've only ever read it. I've never actually heard it pronounced, so I don't know what the answer is.
Okay.
But what I was saying is that, you know, even the most hardcore ufologists will admit that, you know, most of the stories are either hoaxes or, you know, and some of them are very easily identifiable hoaxes, and some of them are very easily identifiable, oh, that was actually Venus, or that was a weather balloon, or that was a star dancing around on the horizon. And, you know, again, even a lot of the most hardcore believers will admit that a great majority of them are mistaken or hoaxes. But even so, that leaves a percentage of them that the skeptics would say we haven't found an explanation for yet. And the ufologists would say those are the real ones.
Right.
What's interesting is that if you look at those over any sort of time period, over any
large sample size.
A large sample size, small sample size, medium sample size, geographic, you know, divided up by geography or whatever else. For the most part, the ones that we can explain, the ones that we can say are hoaxes, the ones that we can say are definitively things that we can explain, the percentage stays the same regardless. So in a year where there's 100 UFO sightings reported, and even the hardcore people believe 90% of them were crap, but they think the other 10 were good. And if there's 1,000, then we can explain 900 of them and 100 of them are not explainable. And what that points to very definitively, statistically, is that either aliens are really, really good at figuring out exactly how many UFO sightings there are going to be in a year and only doing real ones for the exact proportion of 10%, or 10% of them are unexplainable just because we can't figure out what they are, but they're not actually aliens.
Wow.
And so I hope I explained that.
No, well, I get it. It would now you're not just thinking about how often does something show up. Now you have to think of, no, there has to be intent involved. If you're talking about that kind of numbers, intentionality comes into, you know.
Right. So in other words, if those 100 were real in 1993 and the 10 were real in 1994, then it means that aliens
came here 100 times in 1993 and only 10 times in 1994. And they did it in the exact proportion to the total number of false UFO sightings that were shown. And that is not a thing that you can
I looked it up, by the way.
Do.
It is pronounced ufology, and it is the study of reports, visual records, purported physical evidence, and other phenomena related to unidentified flying objects, as a field has not been embraced by academia and is considered a pseudoscience. But as we established many, many episodes ago, pseudoscience is still a science.
We should change the name of the podcast to Pseudoscience versus Fiction. All right, so grades.
I'm going to let you wrap this up. I think that Fire in the Sky is kind of dry, not bad, but kind of dry for an hour and then legitimately gut punch scary. I give it a B- and I definitely recommend it. Not for kids, but check it out.
Yeah. I mean, I think for that scene alone, I think the rest of the movie is good. I don't think it's bad. I don't think it never felt, at least the first time I watched it, never felt TV movie of the week to me. It felt compelling. And then that scene punches you in the gut. And I think for that scene alone, it's an A-. And I think that any other movie leading up to that scene would make that scene less effective. And so I think that taken as a whole, it's an A-, because that scene works the way it does because it's in this movie.
Yeah, no, it's not just that sequence is great. It's that the film places it in a moment that makes it great. So, you know,
although let's be honest, I think if you just watch that scene entirely out of context, you probably would still be freaky, but I don't think it would be as freaky as.
Yeah, but you also, by that point, you care about D.B. Sweeney and to a degree Robert Patrick and the girl that D.B. Sweeney's going to marry. Like, so you care a bit. So that, and then that, all that nasty stuff is like much more effective.
Yeah.
So
scientific intelligence, it's hard to say because again, aside from that scene, the story hews very, very closely to at least what these guys claimed that they did. So, I don't think it deserves a grade for scientific intelligence because either these guys are telling the truth, in which case everything we think we know about it, the way the universe works, is wrong, or they're full of crap, and so there is some pseudoscience in it in terms of the hypnosis and in terms of the polygraphs, but that is all stuff that actually happened. So it's hard to say whether it's good or bad on the science front as a piece of fiction.
N-A for science. And thank you so much for tuning in to this inevitably lengthy episode. Stephen's going to cut probably a third of it, and it's still probably going to be one of our longest episodes, but we hope you can settle in, be safe and comfortable, and enjoy your podcasts. We want to thank everybody at Audio Boom for welcoming us onto their network, and I want to thank Stephen once again, and thank you for tuning in.
Thank you guys for listening, and we'll see you next week.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.